Greetings and regressions, my fine listeners, and welcome to this February 2013 Science News Update. I'm your host for this hitting streak struck science podcast, Jim Campanella. I was reminded earlier this month when I did my first story narration in quite a while that I have done this little science podcast edition for Starship Sofa every month since 2008. That is an unbroken hitting streak that I suspect no other contributor, except for Tony, has the honor of holding. I'm not sure whether to cheer or be worried about my sanity. My wife insists I have too much stress and I don't sleep enough between my job and the kids and the house and the science podcast and my bookcast and martial arts and trying to keep up with my writing. I'm going to try to simplify my life a little bit tonight with an offer to you listeners, or at least the ones who are narrators. I have been regularly doing the Uvula audio bookcast for longer than I have been a member of the Starship Sofa crew. Take a look at uvulaaudio.com if you are curious. uvulaaudio.com. My own podcast is the presentation of mainly whole novels that are now in the public domain and or have not been published in so long that they may as well be in the public domain. Uvula has recorded everything from H.P. Lovecraft to L. Frank Baum stories. We also present pulp crime like The Avenger and Doc Savage, as well as classic genre fiction from the likes of Andre Norton. I have not had another narrator on the team in a while, and it is getting to be a bit of a slog. I still love doing the narrations, and people apparently love to download them, but perhaps I'm slowing a bit? At any rate, the Starship Sofa podcast seems as good a place as any to put out the call for any narrator who would like to try reading a longer form than the short stories found on here. If you're interested, contact me with your demo MP3s at campanella@uvulaaudio.com. We can talk about possible projects and what is presently available in terms of upcoming books. If you'd like to narrate long-term, great. If you want to do a one-shot just to try it out, also great. At any rate, any help that I could get would really reduce my workload and perhaps help me to get beyond the midpoint of my newest novel. I better stop now. I'm supposed to be talking about science and not shilling for my own podcast. Alrighty. The first two stories of the night are a bit of an update on the science misconduct stories that I've been relaying to you over the last couple of months. Of those two stories, the first comes from the last issue of the journal MBio, and the story is by Dr. Ferrick Fang, a researcher at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Fang reports something that probably should not come as much of a surprise. He found out that two-thirds of researchers responsible for recent cases of scientific misconduct in the life sciences are male, across all career stages and from 1994 to 2012. Men are overrepresented in misconduct cases compared to women in the field. This new analysis is the first to look at differences in misconduct rates between the genders, and it adds to a growing collection of data that aims to explain who commits scientific fraud and why. Fang's team used data from the U.S. Office of Research Integrity that provided details on 228 misconduct cases that have come up over the last 12 years. His team parsed the data by career stage, students, postdoctoral fellows, research personnel, and faculty members, since each has a different gender balance. 65% of the misconduct was attributed to men. Among faculty members, 88% of the cases were committed by men, who make up less than 70% of the total population of scientists. More misconduct, about 32%, was attributed to faculty members than students, about 16%, or postdocs, 25%, or other research personnel, which is about 28%. Most people automatically assume that you will find students being bad scientists before their mentors, but that doesn't seem to be the case. It also seems that efforts to combat misconduct in students and postdocs are pretty damned misguided. Somebody needs to have a long talk with the PIs, that's the primary investigator, the senior faculties on those grants. Fang says, quote, "Further sociological research is needed to reveal what factors may be at play in the gender imbalance, and much data is still lacking because scientists accused of misconduct infrequently speak publicly about their cases, unquote. The second scientific misconduct story should send taxpayers, at least in the USA, into a tizzy. Dr. Harold Garner, a professor at Virginia Tech, published an article in Nature last week on an analysis that makes one simple claim. And that claim is this: a whole series of research projects over the last 10 years in the U.S. have been funded multiple times and cost taxpayers untold amounts of money. Garner analyzed over 600,000 grant and contract summaries from the largest U.S. funders using a supercomputer that he built called ShadowFax. The grant applications were drawn from the five largest funders in the United States: the Susan J. Komen Foundation for the Cure, the DOD, the DOE, NSF, and NIH. His analysis found that overall, tens of millions of dollars were awarded to projects that appeared to have already been funded partially or completely funded by those agencies. Hence, a large number of grant holders have been double-dipping. ShadowFax conducted about 200 billion text comparisons between the grant abstracts to identify similar or duplicate projects. Then Garner's team filtered the data to remove applications that looked like they were connected to conferences or large projects that would require funding from multiple agencies. While the computer immediately identified several thousand possible duplications, the analysis required further human review because unique grant applications from the same research group often contain similar wording and research background sections. So Garner had to personally review every grant pair the computer flagged as potential duplicates. By the time he was finished, Garner identified 167 pairs of grants that they believed were likely to have been double funded. Between 2007 and 2011, they identified 39 pairs that totaled more than $20 million in research funding. That is, of course, $20 million that could have gone to other researchers who were deserving of funding. Garner is convinced that the findings greatly underestimate the amount of double-dipping that actually does exist. He says, quote, "We know from surveys of scientists that a large fraction, maybe a couple of percent, admit to having plagiarized. We found only a tenth of a percent or so, so we know there is about 35 times more plagiarism being done than we can discover with our software," unquote. You can do the calculations yourself, but if a similar number of researchers are dishonest in their grant applications, the amount of duplicate funding might be as much as $5 billion since 1985, or about 2 to 3% of all funds. That's what Garner has calculated, and he insists that he is just scratching the surface of the iceberg here. Garner estimates that just in the area of NIH research, that the amount of money spent on double-funded projects since 1985 is probably about $300 million. He says, quote, "There is a lot of research that could be funded for money saved if double-dipping is curtailed," unquote. Garner also makes it very clear in his article, just like me, that he wouldn't mind a piece of all that money that gets saved from those scientists who are doubling up. Next story. I've been saying for years that breakthroughs in genetic technology would soon allow everyone to have their DNA sequenced for a reasonable price and speed. That has pretty much come to pass in the last year or so, as the price of genomic sequencing has fallen to about $1,000. I also warned everyone all those years ago when I first started talking about this that human genome sequencing could potentially be abused by insurance companies, potential employers, and even governmental agencies. Well, I have to admit that I never really thought that the next story would be possible, let alone that it would happen so quickly. Dr. Yaniv Ehrlich of the Whitehead Institute has just published a paper in the January issue of the journal Science that explains how he took anonymous DNA sequence data and figured out whose DNA it was. I am still astounded by this and cannot believe that such data is not more secure. Genotype data of thousands of individuals are deposited and accessed in online databases involved with the Thousand Genomes Project, and the data are supposed to be anonymous. Using only publicly available internet tools, Ehrlich deduced the identity of 50 individuals who submitted personal genetic material to the Thousand Genomes Project. Ehrlich says, quote, "You could sit next to your computer, and if you have the right knowledge, you can go all the way from sequence files and the thousand genomes just using public tools, and in some cases go back to the people," unquote. Before Ehrlich worked in science, he tested bank security systems, so it's not exactly surprising for him to wonder about the security of public genetic data. Ehrlich and his team used a computer tool they developed called Lobster to analyze genetic information made public by the Thousand Genomes Project. They focused on the Y chromosome because both the Y chromosome and family surnames are transmitted from father to son and do stay together, providing kind of a ripe target for identification. Then Ehrlich's team put the Lobster results into two online databases, YSearch and SMGF. And both of these are free of charge websites that allow individuals to search for genealogy matches based on Y chromosome genetic data. On average, the database returned a last name associated with the genetic information 12% of the time. The problem is that thousands of individuals in the U.S. have the same last names. So for the final step, Ehrlich's team used age and state of residency. That is demographic information that is not protected by the U.S. privacy laws and is typically associated with genetic data online. They used that to narrow their results to specific individuals. Ehrlich said, quote, "We went from 300 million people in the U.S. very quickly to just two males, and that was just based on public searches. At that point, we could just call each of them and ask if they had actually participated in a genetic study," unquote. It's scary stuff. Ehrlich refuses to reveal any of the names he discovered, which is good. He says that he did not do this work to get the databases closed or get them shut down, but to point up where they are weak and to get them shored up. Quote, "The focus of the study is to illuminate the current status of genetic privacy, to engage public discussion about it, and to maybe get some better legislation and policies to protect data misuse," unquote. When Ehrlich went to the NIH directors with his results, they immediately altered the database to remove age data, hence making it that much harder to associate a particular person with a particular genome. Ehrlich calls this just a stopgap, and he is still in conversations with the powers that be to make the security process even better. The next story was sent to me by listener C.J. Urso. The article came out in late January in the journal Nature Chemistry, which is not one that I tend to read very often, since I am not much of a chemist, but still, the article seems to be much more biology-based than chemistry-based, at least as far as I'm concerned. It comes out of the departments of chemistry and biochemistry at the University of Cambridge, UK, and the lab of Dr. Shankar Balasubramanian. Considering that the original double helical structure of DNA was discovered at Cambridge by Watson and Crick some 60 years ago, it's only appropriate that a new structural breakthrough in DNA is revealed there as well. Balasubramanian has discovered a new form of DNA that is actually quadruplexed. That is, it is wrapped into a four-strand structure. Although it has been known for years that you can do this in a test tube under the right chemical conditions, which promotes something called Hoogsteen base pairing, this is the first time that anyone has ever shown in living cells that this quadruplexed structure has any biological significance. Balasubramanian's lab developed antibodies that very specifically recognize quadruplex DNA so that it can be identified in a chromosome or a cell. Balasubramanian's team identified the four-strand structures in cancer cells with the help of his specific antibody that attaches exclusively to G quadruplexes. To stop them from unraveling into ordinary DNA, they expose the cells to piridostatin, a molecule that traps quadruple helixes whenever they form. This enabled the authors to count how many of these formed at each stage of cell multiplication while the cancer cells divided. The quadruplexes were most abundant in the S phase of development. The S phase is when cells replicate their DNA just prior to dividing. Balasubramanian says, quote, "I expect the quadruplexes will also exist in normal cells, but I predict that there will be differences with cancer cells. I have a hunch that the quadruplexes are triggered into action by chaotic genomic mutation and reorganizations typical of cancerous or precancerous cells, unquote. Another important question that Balasubramanian will try to answer is whether G quadruplexes play a role in embryo development, and whether such a role is mistakenly reactivated in cancer cells. In short, he wants to know whether the structures are pathogenic or simply part of the process of cell division and development. On to the next story. I've been arguing with my parents for years about whether flu shots are bad for you or not. They insist that not only should both my wife and I not get flu shots, but we should not allow our kids to get them either, as if our school system would allow such a thing. They share the opinion of many other people that flu shots are more likely to make you ill than actually prevent illness, this despite any actual corroborating evidence to support that belief. Well, the next story addresses this issue, at least in part, and answers the question of whether it is better and safer for a pregnant woman to get a flu shot or not to get a flu shot. This month in the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Camilla Stoltenberg of the Norwegian Institute of Public Health in Oslo examined whether it is worse for a pregnant woman to get the flu or to get a flu vaccine. It turns out that getting the flu appears to nearly double a pregnant woman's risk of having a miscarriage or stillbirth, but getting vaccinated during pregnancy greatly reduces a woman's risk of flu without any other associated risks. In short, the study also finds that getting a flu shot during pregnancy is safe. Anecdotal reports, such as my parents relate, had suggested that flu vaccination during gestation might have adverse effects on the fetus, but the new study, as well as two previous reports from Canada and Denmark, now show no such connection. Stoltenberg scanned Norway's National Registry of Medical Information and identified more than 100,000 pregnancies during late 2009. Pregnant women who received the flu vaccine were one-third as likely to get the flu as were unvaccinated pregnant women. Stoltenberg said, quote, "Our results confirm findings from other recent studies that have found no association between flu vaccination and stillbirth or other adverse events in pregnancy," unquote. Stoltenberg also tabulated miscarriages and stillbirths that occurred during the second and third trimesters of pregnancy. Among the children born to roughly 26,000 vaccinated mothers, there were 78 fetal deaths. 414 fetal deaths occurred among 87,000 unvaccinated mothers. The researchers calculated that women who got the flu were almost twice as likely to lose the fetus than unaffected women. My reading suggests that influenza hits pregnant women much harder than other women, and that flu shots have been recommended for pregnant women for decades. But apparently lots of women do not get the shots because of warped perceptions and old wives' tales. One of those warped perceptions is that, well, the flu is just the flu, and it won't affect a pregnant woman any worse than a non-pregnant one. In short, they think, big deal, it's just the flu. And that's not true. Flu can increase the chances of fetal death. It's not entirely clear what the connection is between flu and fetal death, but the authors of this paper and other scientists suspect that high fever and systemic inflammation in the mother are a major cause. Well, the last story of the night suggests that you can now blame your grandparents for you being overweight. And you always knew it wasn't your fault anyway, right? Another environmental toxin/pollutant has the potential to cause a lot of problems out there, and for multiple generations, not just one. So even if the toxin were removed now, at least two generations would still be affected. Welcome to the modern world. So Dr. Raquel Chamorro Garcia of UC Irvine reported last month in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives that exposure in the womb to a chemical used to make PVC plastic, and also ship paint, promotes obesity in mice. Not only does it make the mice fatter, but the effect is long-lasting. The mice's grandchildren were also fat, even though they had never had exposure to the chemical. The authors are calling the chemical pollutant an obesogen, that is, a chemical that encourages fat accumulation. This new nasty compound is called tributyltin, and it is often added to PVC as a stabilizer, and also to marine paint as an anti-fouling agent. Comoro Garcia fed pregnant mice tributyltin in their drinking water at levels similar to what people might ingest through house dust and other sources. The mice gave birth to pups that developed more and larger fat cells, as well as fattier livers compared with unexposed pups. And here's the most disturbing thing about this. Although they have not checked yet beyond the third generation, the authors believe that the physical changes in the mice may be permanent. The children and grandchildren of these mice also increased their amounts of body and liver fat. The findings confirm previous work shown that tributyltin affects the functions of a gene that regulates body fat production and reprograms certain stem cells to become fat cells rather than bone cells. Apparently, that reprogramming is passed along to the next generations, although it's not entirely clear how that is possible. It's likely that the alterations are being retained at an epigenetic level, because just changing somatic cells should not also be changing offspring. Does it work like this in humans? Well, we have no idea. But it's safe to bet that the new defensive cry of the overweight in the future will not be, "I'm big boned." It'll be, "My dad was a plumber and laid PVC pipe." Or, "My mom painted ships for a living." I suspect that this obesogen thing will not be going away very soon. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, get your flu shots, don't chew on shipped bulkheads or PVC pipes, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.